can't predict if we still continue to have people who are falling into homelessness because they can't pay the rent, if there's not state help, if there's no federal assistance, we're going to be doing the mop-up work.
Mayor Eric Garcetti addressing the news that LA's homeless population grew by 16% in the city last year, despite the fact that 2 years ago, residents voted overwhelmingly to tax themselves, that's Measure HHH, to help build more housing to try to stem this homelessness problem. Well, the growing crisis is not just an LA problem. In Orange County, homelessness is up by 40%. That's in part because officials there changed the way they conduct their annual count. In San Francisco, up by 17%. All to say, this is a bigger problem than any one city or county can fix on their own. Here to talk about what the state is doing is Peter Lin, Executive Director of the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, the mayor says last year the city housed more than 20,000 people, so that's more than ever before, he says. But the rate at which people are falling into homelessness is exceeding that. So what's to be done?
I think that's right. I think we need work on several fronts. Obviously, we need to address the crisis of people who are experiencing homelessness right now, and those are the resources we're deploying through the local measures like Measure H and Proposition Triple H that are going to build more units. We need more state funding. The HEAP funds from last year were very helpful, but we have more people who are homeless now than we can currently reach. We also need to address housing affordability. We need to go upstream to both provide immediate relief for renters in this marketplace that's been very, very challenging. But over time, we need to increase housing stock. We also need to increase the kinds of stock we have so that the market can build deeply affordable units like we had leading up to the 70s. And we also need to think through both broad public policy issues that impact people who are vulnerable to homelessness. We need to get upstream with people who have histories with criminal justice and make sure we're doing better work on reentry and removing barriers to their employment and their housing. We need to go upstream in the health system and make sure that people with serious mental illness and substance use disorders are getting the kind of help they need. So there's a broad level of effort that needs to take place on many, many fronts, state
yeah.
level, federal level, local level.
It sounds like all hands on deck, a tall order, a long list of things that need to be done maybe yesterday, and a lot of money involved.
I think that's right, but I will say that resources matter, and we can show results with the resources that have been put in place. If you look at the count in Los Angeles, which did show an increase last year, the one area where we showed a slight decrease in the people experiencing homelessness was in our count of veterans. Year after year, Congress has put more money and more resources behind that, and that is the one population where, with those resources, we can actually show a decrease despite the fact that the poorest Angelenos are falling into homelessness at an ever-increasing rate.
Okay, so what you're saying, though, is saying we need more federal money for everybody.
I think I would say more federal money for everybody. We've seen cuts on the federal level, both in terms of direct program funding for programs that address affordability, like the Community Development Block Grant Program and the home funds, but also effective cuts by not keeping Section 8 funding up to the level of cost in the housing market. So if you don't keep up with the actual inflation in the rental market, effectively you're serving fewer households because the money doesn't go as far. Those both matter. We could use federal assistance, we could also use state assistance on this and on policy fronts.
Well, how do you rate the governor in terms of his ability and his actions so far in addressing this problem?
Well, he certainly put the topic foremost. We are very encouraged to see Supervisor Ridley Thomas on the new task force, and obviously the mayor of Sacramento is very focused on this area. But Supervisor Ridley Thomas brings the Los Angeles perspective, and he's a strong advocate for the need to address homelessness.
Okay, just pause for a second, just to explain. This is the Homeless and Supportive Housing Advisory Task Force. The governor has convened.
Right. That's correct.
Right.
The state has also begun to vote new resources in through these budgets to address emergency funds. But we are hopeful that this administration and this interest persists and shows up with policy initiatives and with resourcing at the local level.
Right. So he proposed a $213 billion state budget recently. $1 billion of that would go to housing services, eviction protection, and other services. Is that enough?
I think we need to start where we can start. It is certainly welcome. The question of whether it's enough, I think we need time to both deploy those resources and evaluate their effectiveness. But it is an excellent start.
So not enough, in other words.
I think we need more than that at all levels, including at the federal level, at the state level. But, we absolutely need to get started. There are tens of thousands of Angelenos who are sleeping on our sidewalks and in their cars, and we need help immediately.
And do you think that this is being addressed with the urgency with which you describe it, you know, just in that last statement? We need it now. Do you think that people in Sacramento are treating it with the same level of urgency?
I would have wanted to see some of the policies that stalled to move forward. I think rent protections are urgently needed statewide, and I think that's one area where the state can act that municipalities may not have the ability to. I think our housing supply needs to be addressed, and so we need to make it easier and more cost-effective to build in this state, and I think the state really can take action on that.
So rental protections, what would that look like?
Well, that would look like, requiring just cause evictions. At this point, landlords can evict for no reason or any reason. It would look like anti-gouging provisions so that there is at least some protection against price movements in the rental market that exceed what anybody could afford. There are a number of initiatives and policies that the state could put forward.
We have a presidential election coming up and a lot of Democratic candidates running for office, as you are no doubt well aware. And California has a very important primary this time around. It's moved up to March. Do you hear anything from the Democratic candidates on this issue that you think, yeah, this is something that means that they're taking this issue seriously and they have a workable proposal?
I think all of us who are in the work to address homelessness are listening closely to the proposals and the policies that are putting forward. I think as this economy has shown a robust strength, it has also left behind many Americans. And I'd really want to hear more solid policy proposals with regard to housing affordability and with regard to income disparities.
Why aren't we hearing more of that from the candidates? It is a top issue amongst voters, from what I understand.
I think it can be a complex issue to articulate. I think sometimes, I will confess, I struggle to understand how to articulate best to people that a booming economy really does mean a greater challenge for the poorest people. It's a complex picture. People think that wages are moving up and that's a good thing for people, and it is. But most of the increase in incomes is actually for households that are above median income. Households that are below median income are not seeing their incomes move nearly as fast. And those that are in the poorest decile, the lowest income households, are seeing decreases in real incomes and are being very, very hard pressed by cost of living increases that are generated by this rising economy, particularly in housing cost inflation. So it is something that's a little harder for people to take in when things look good. But it's important to remember that if you leave behind the poorest Americans, you're leaving behind 30 million people who are getting very, very hard-pressed in this market.
Peter Lin, Executive Director of the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll talk with the new chair of the California Democratic Party about how he plans to unify a fractious party next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Rusty Hicks was elected the new chair of the California Democratic Party. The LA labor leader and Navy veteran will succeed Eric Bauman. Bauman resigned in November after he was accused of sexually harassing his staffers. Hicks's election is a big win for the party establishment, and they hope he will be able to unite this scandal-plagued party ahead of the 2020 elections. And Rusty Hicks joins me now. Welcome.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Well, how divided is your party? There was a fight for the election, and but you won. Your main opposition, Kimberly Ellis, and she wanted to bring in more diverse, younger faces to the party. Is that a serious divide?
Well, I view it as the campaign is over. We have the opportunity to move forward and unite the party. You know, I think that the passion and the energy that was brought to that campaign is important for our party. And now we've got a lot of work to do. And
what
I
is that
we
work?
We have the opportunity to
exactly.
do that together.
What is that work?
Well, certainly, you know, first and foremost is preparing to remove Donald Trump from the White House in 2020. We certainly have some work to do in 2019 to get our party in a position to put our best foot forward for that campaign, not the least of which is actually addressing the reason why we had a chair's race to begin with. I think that's the number one issue that we have to face and address and ensure never happens again.
You mean the sexual harassment allegations?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Okay.
Absolutely.
So there are lawsuits regarding that. Is that going to take up a fair amount of your time addressing that?
Well, I think first we have to certainly squarely and directly ensure that we address the pain and suffering that victims have experienced. But also, I think it's important to put in place policies and systems that ensure that it doesn't happen again, that anyone and everyone who engages with the California Democratic Party feels safe and is safe. And I started some 2 months ago developing a zero tolerance policy for the party, and I'm prepared to implement that new policy within 30 days.
I want to get back to this division during this race for party chair. One of the delegates who supported Kimberly Ellis said, "If I, as a young Black woman in this party, can't see myself in leadership, then what's the point?" And then she pointed out that the Republican Party, the California Republican Party, recently elected a Latina to lead its party. Do you see that at all as a problem, that in this majority-minority state, a white man is leading the Democratic Party?
Well, I talked about actually building a Democratic Party that members of the party helped to lead. My leadership style has never been about one individual at the top. It has been about the collective power of all of us. And therefore, I called for really the democratization of the way in which we select committees, the expansion of the leadership structure at the top statewide levels of our party. And therefore, I think through my work in the labor movement in Los Angeles and what I hope to do with this party, I hope that every part of our party will see backgrounds and demographics and geographies and ideas that reflect them.
What is the primary function of the Democratic Party here in California? Is it mainly to raise money for candidates?
Yeah. I believe that the role of the party is to engage and empower 9 million Democrats to bring the platform of the party to life that actually improves the lives of 40 million Californians. The vast majority of Californians are looking for a job that they can rely on. They want a good education for their kids. They want a home that they can actually afford. They want health care when they're sick. They want clean air and clean water. And it's our party's obligation to prioritize and lead on and speak to those important issues to be the core function, the primary role of the party.
Well, speaking of one of those issues that you outlined, home affordability, there was, as you no doubt are aware, a major study on homelessness that came out yesterday that showed double-digit gains here in Los Angeles. We are in a Democratic state. We have a Democratic governor. There's a supermajority in the legislature of Democrats. And yet it appears that state government is failing to properly address the housing crisis. There just aren't enough homes at affordable prices for people, which is one of the major reasons for this homelessness epidemic. So why hasn't your party been able to really put forth aggressive measures to solve this problem?
Well, I would say it's certainly the homelessness challenge that our state faces and the housing crisis that we face are certainly linked. I also think we have a challenge of good quality jobs, and that is linked to really both of those important issues. And having been engaged in both the jobs issues and the housing issues and the homelessness issues here in Los Angeles, I can tell you that there is no one-size-fits-all solution. There is no magic wand to address these issues. I mean, at the end of the day, it's about ensuring that folks have a job that they can provide for themselves and their families on.
But unemployment, I'm sorry to interrupt, unemployment is pretty low. People do have jobs, but they can't afford to live here.
Yeah,
housing is just outrageously expensive for most people.
And I agree. In many ways, the challenge is that there simply isn't enough construction being done.
And what is the role of the legislature to change that?
Well, I think it's to ensure that they bring all the parties to the table, keep them at the table until a deal is done that ensures that we are constructing housing at scale and ensuring that those that construct that housing can actually afford to live in what they build. And we are preserving and protecting our environment. So I think the measures that the legislature has put forward, prioritizing building of density around transit hubs.
Well, but that was just killed this year. That's not going to be voted on this year.
Because
there wasn't enough political will to get that even voted on. So when you have a proposal like that can't even be voted on, how do you get anything done?
But I do think it speaks to the challenge of this issue.
Do you believe in publicly financed elections?
I believe that we should ensure that every candidate has a real opportunity to have their voice heard, to make their case. And I think to the extent that we can move closer to publicly financed elections, all the better.
What would that entail? Would that entail limiting corporate donors?
I think there's a variety of different options and ways about going into public financing. I think the ultimate goal is to ensure that grassroots candidates have the opportunity to make their case to voters to ensure that we get the best ideas and the best candidates elected into public office.
Rusty Hicks, newly elected chair of the California Democratic Party, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, breaking barriers in the new rom-com Always Be My Maybe. Nearly every actor on it, Asian American.
It definitely showcases that there are different kinds of stories to be told. There are different ways to tell familiar stories. And there are audiences out there who crave this content.
Director Ninotchka Khan, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, rom-coms can be pretty predictable. Two people, for some reason, aren't together. They should be, then they are, and they nearly always end in a wedding, rom-coms. Well, the new Netflix movie, Always Be My Maybe, largely doesn't stray from that formula, except in one way, one really interesting way. Nearly the entire cast is Asian. The stars are Ali Wong and Randall Park. Maybe you've seen Wong's stand-up special, it's called Baby Cobra, or Park on Fresh Off the Boat. In this movie, they play childhood friends who run into each other again as adults after going their separate ways. She's become a celebrity chef here in LA, and she's back in San Francisco to open a new restaurant. He has never left. Here's a scene between Marcus, played by Randall Park, and his dad, played by James Saito.
You and Sasha are great together. You always have been.
Sasha thinks she knows everything about everything. Plus, she's a celebrity now, and all celebrities are insane. I once saw Glenn Close order a pineapple sandwich. Jenny is a kind and compassionate person, and she cares about the community.
And Sasha is Sasha. There's no one else like her, and you know it. You do know it, don't you? That's what I thought. You don't want to wonder what if. Tell her how you feel, son.
Okay, so then he tries to tell her, and something, someone gets in the way. Always Be My Maybe, directed by TV showrunner Nanochka Khan. She created Fresh Off the Boat and Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23. This is her first feature film, and she's here now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, shall we reveal what the thing is?
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
It's out. It's Keanu. It's Keanu Reeves. He's playing himself. He comes in, you know, as Marcus's worst nightmare, basically.
Right. Any yeah. guy's worst nightmare, right?
His... especially when, you know, he's trying to confess his feelings that he loves her. She's like, oh my God, I'm seeing someone. And then it's Keanu.
That's a pretty brilliant touch.
I mean, I'm so happy that he could do it and that people are into it and finally see it. Because it's been making us laugh for over a year. So.
Yeah, for sure. And also, I didn't know until I did a little research that he is part Asian.
Yeah. As Ali Wong says, she's trying to claim him. He's Chinese Hawaiian, part yeah. of, you know, his ancestry is Chinese Hawaiian. So
she's trying to claim him.
She's claiming him. She's like, he is ours.
Does he want to be claimed?
Yeah, I believe so.
Sure, why not? He's Keanu.
Keanu's all things to all people.
Exactly. Okay, so talk about the two stars, Randall Park, you've known for years, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
From Fresh Off the Boat.
From Fresh. And also Ali Wong from Fresh. She was a writer on the first two seasons of the show. So she and I were in the trenches together. And then, yeah, I've known Randall, you know, for 6 years now.
And the two of them wrote this?
The two of them wrote this with their friend, Mike Golomko. So, yeah.
And they thought, we need to make a rom-com with only Asians in it, or mainly Asians in it.
Ali and Randall are friends for a long time. They've known each other since, you know, 2000 or something. And for a long time, they've been talking about doing their version of When Harry Met Sally. So the New Yorker profiled Ali after Baby Cobra blew up. She mentioned that. That's just like one line in the article. And just based on that, like off of that, their phones started ringing. People wanted the script. And so they were like, we better write the script. So they all sat down. The three of them sat down to write it. And then Netflix was like, we want to make this movie.
And then how do you get involved in it?
So, I mean, I know those guys already. Mm-hmm. And I was involved early on. They brought me in as sort of like a consultant to kind of help them shape the story and everything. And then I was set to direct another movie for Lionsgate, and that fell apart in the 11th hour, but I had sort of made a window for that in my schedule. So then these guys were like, oh, what about our movie? So it kind of just, I mean, I was so lucky that it worked out.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And yeah. So when you say you kind of helped shape it, what did that entail?
It's a long process, you know, to get a movie kind of ready to be shot and to be prepped and everything. So as they went through the notes process and the rewrites and things like that, kind of helping them, you know, kind of shape it towards like what they wanted the movie to be and what they wanted to say and that kind of thing. You know, because we all love the genre, the mm-hmm. rom-com genre. So we knew we wanted to like tip our hat to some of the things, but we wanted to make it fresh, you know, and have it feel very 2019 as well.
Like there's a sex scene in a car when they're teenagers.
Yeah.
You got to have that, right?
You got to have
the bouncing car.
To D'Angelo.
To D'Angelo. You know.
I mean, who among us has it?
Well,
Madeline, come on.
All right. But it's a pretty funny scene because, of course, it's awkward.
I mean, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they were so great at that. And that was kind of shot in a way where, you know, they obviously start in the front seat. And once they start kissing and making out, it's like it was just like, OK, you guys have to wind up in the back. However you want to get there, the most uncomfortable, awkward way. Let's try it. So we did like several takes. And in the movie, I just sort of let it play out and you see the awkward fumble.
Right. And the car just collapsed. The seat just collapsed.
Yeah. Like he tries to be suave and hit the thing where the back goes down. And she had a funny sound that she made. So that's all in there. And it was making us all laugh.
It was really great because then cut to when they're adults and they meet each other again.
Mm-hmm.
He's driving the same car.
He's got that same Corolla. Yeah. From back in the day. It's all taped, like the bumper's taped on. I think we tried to give him like a bunch of bumper stickers that were like We wanted like all the different elections, one over the other. I don't think we ever got that on screen. But yeah, it was fun.
But it's an interesting idea to make the guy the unambitious one.
Allie grew up in the Bay Area, which is where the movie takes place, in San Francisco. And she knows a lot of people like Marcus. And he's unambitious, but he's also very talented. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an interesting combo, because it's not like, oh, you're still living with your parents and you're in a band and your band sucks, so it makes sense that you're, you know, he's living with his dad, he's a musician, and his band is amazing. And so that's the question of, like, for those of us like myself who are more ambitious, like, you're always like, but don't you want more? Like, you could be, you're so good. And then when the answer is always like, no, I'm good. Like, I'm good with this piece of the street. It's always interesting for me to ask that question of somebody.
But what's also interesting is usually in these movies, it's, oh, yeah, I need to go back home because that's where the real values are. Mm-hmm. That's where the truth is. That's where life has more meaning than in the big city where right. nobody knows each other and everyone's only out for their own, you know, for their greed and money and ambition, et cetera.
Right.
And you kind of flip that on its head and say, well, actually,
yeah,
there's something to be said for getting out of the small town.
And also, like, the reason that he hasn't left is he's sort of stuck in this. There's a traumatic incident that happens early in the movie to him, and he gets stuck. And, you know, you see that play out as well, mm-hmm. where it's not like a hardcore trauma that's raising its head in every single moment, but it's pervasive in his life. And I think somebody who knows you from that time is the person that sort of pointed out to you. It would have been a different story if they'd met as adults, you know, as opposed to they knew each other as kids, they grew up next door to each other. She knows him in a way that a lot of other people don't. So it was
and
a good
he knows
conflict.
Her in a way that
exactly.
other people don't.
Exactly.
Including Keanu. Okay, getting back to Keanu.
Yep. Yeah.
We have to.
I mean.
Let's play a clip from a scene where this is in the restaurant. So Ali Wong is dating Keanu, mm-hmm. and it's a double date with Randall Park and his girlfriend.
Played by Vivian Bang, mm-hmm. who's amazing.
She's incredible. Mm-hmm. She plays this kind of hippie, dippy girl who's
Asian with dreadlocks.
Yeah, that's all you
Allie
need
has
to say.
Some questions about that in the movie.
That's a wig, right?
It is a wig, yeah.
Okay.
We worked hard on that wig.
So they're all in this really pretentious restaurant. Keanu knows everyone there, but yet he's trying to be humble or pretend that he's humble.
So, Henry.
It's Marcus.
So, Marcus, I hear you're in a band.
Oh, they are so awesome. They could be really huge if they wanted to be.
Have I heard of you guys on the festival circuit?
No, we're just a block band.
See, that right there is what it's all about. Laboring in obscurity, starving and struggling. The man who embraces his mediocre nothingness shines greater than any.
So was he okay with that portrayal of him?
1,000%. Like, he, you know, we'd sent him the script and he wanted to sit down and meet with us. First of all, he read the whole script. Like, a lot of people, I think of his stature, probably would just read their section. He read the entire thing. So he was talking to us about, like, how his character fits in with the bigger love story between Sasha and Marcus. And then he started pitching just, like, ideas. You know, we have a bit where there, he wears frames with no lenses in them. That was his pitch, where he's like, I think it would be funny if I'm like getting ready for a part. The beginning of the clip that you just played where he calls uh-huh. him Henry.
Yeah.
That was something that we just did on the day that he just called him Henry. And we just thought it was so funny. He's like, it's Marcus.
He's so funny.
He's so funny and in game to like play, you know, yeah. play around.
So it seems like it's a thing now to have Asian American spotlighted in movies, right? Crazy Rich Asians, for example, To All the Boys I've Loved Before, Killing Eve, even, with Sandra Oh.
Love that show.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Amazing.
Yeah, so this seems like a watershed moment.
It definitely showcases that there are different kinds of stories to be told. There are different ways to tell familiar stories. And there are audiences out there who crave this content. And all those things that you referenced are all amazing movies and shows and things like that, and they're just told from a different point of view, and they're just imbued with like this different spirit, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that people are into it, people are feeling it,
right?
You know?
Right. And in a way that it's not look what I'm doing, but just this is normal life. It just so happens that, you know, Asian Americans are playing the roles.
That's it. I mean, like, this movie, Ali and Randall wrote the script. You know what I mean? So it was never a question of who's going to be Marcus, who's going to be Sasha. It's like, it's for them, you know? And to Netflix's credit, like, from the get-go, they were 100% on board with that. It was never a question of, should we get somebody out? Like, is there, you know, is this going to be broad enough in its appeal or anything, you know, that you might expect? It was 100% on board.
Right, right. And then Fresh Off the Boat, of course, is part of that. And maybe was the first one, really.
Well, I think, you know,
it's a breakthrough.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, we premiered, Fresh Off the Boat premiered in February of 2015, which is not that long ago in years. I mean, it's only like 4 years ago. Right. But the industry has changed so much in the past 4 years. Like, those, again, those projects you referenced, they've all within the last few years. So I remember when we were premiering the show, like, the big kind of question was, are people going to watch? Because there hadn't been a primarily Asian American network sitcom since Margaret Cho's All American Girl, which was in 94.
Wow.
So it had been 20 years. So it was a big question mark. And I feel very proud of, like, the door that our show and other shows like us helped open. I mean, there's obviously much more to do, you know, but I'd rather be where we are in 2019 than where we were in 2015, you know?
Yeah. And you're Iranian-American.
I am.
So your parents are from Iran?
They're both born in Iran, yeah.
I guess there's not as much representation of Iranian-Americans on TV or any really Middle Easterners at all.
My big representation when I was a kid was the Iron Sheik from wrestling. I don't know if you were a fan of, you know, he was a villain everywhere except for our house where we were. He was a hero. And my whole family would sit around the TV and watch the Iron Sheik. He's a comedic genius.
Win?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
So he was a heel.
He was a heel, him, and they paired him up with the Russian Nikolai Volkov.
Of course, the two heels.
You know, against, like, Hulk Hogan and, you know, all the heroes.
Well, we saw how it turned out for Hulk Hogan.
Well, there you go. Shut down Gawker. So.
Yeah, I guess.
who has the final
heel?
Laugh?
Who's the hero? I don't know. Nanochka Khan, director of Always Be My Maybe. It's on Netflix. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, lots of sets are not eco-friendly. Why TV, movie, and commercial sets do not recycle, largely in a city and industry filled with people sympathetic to the cause. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. At least 100 professional film, TV, or commercial shoots take place in the LA area on any given day. So that means thousands of people working and thousands of people generating tons of waste, food, plastic, most of it not recycled. On any given day on set, cast and crew are provided full meals, plus food in between takes, food in between meals. There's food everywhere all the time. Here's a sample.
10:03 a.m., fruit selection. Boats or bowls? Grapes, blueberries, dragon fruit, Washington cherries, kumquats, dates, blueberries, strawberries, pears.
Okay, that's an assistant director who wanted to be anonymous. He's on a big commercial shoot, and he recorded the day's snack offerings on his iPhone.
Kiwi, mango, nectarine, plum. Coconut.
All right, there's more. We're going to check back
lychee,
in with him later.
Grapefruit.
Well, so far that all sounds pretty delicious, but what happens to the food that's not consumed at the end of the day? A lot of it is eaten, but a lot of it is tossed. A big movie can generate 72 tons of food waste. We're going to talk now with Nick Kane. He works on sets in the grip and electric department, and he's in the studio with us now. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, first of all, what does a grip do? Let's get that out of the way.
Well, technically, there's grip and electric, but in the non-union world that I mostly work in, grip and electric can be synonymous as set lighting.
Okay, so you are on set, and you see everything that we just heard, right?
Those
tables laden with stuff to eat.
Well, you see that more in the larger sets. Uh-huh. I've worked on big network shows, and I've also worked on a lot of smaller indie stuff, and particularly on the big network shows. There's a certain thing, you know, where, it's not worth it to worry about that as much because you're dealing with celebrities and celebrities' time, and their time and stuff makes the margins go crazy because ultimately, oh, that's like nickels and dimes compared to like this money that we're dealing with.
So the food would be the nickels and dimes.
Yeah. But there's more to food than just money.
Right.
You know, like there's the environmental impact of everything. And I think we need some type of balance to where, you know, there is more care for the environmental than just the numbers and just the dollars and cents.
So when you're on a set like that and you see all this food, does most of it get eaten?
Depends. If it's a lower budget set, most of it does. Because on the smaller sets, you're not dealing with huge margins of waste.
Mm-hmm.
When you're working on more indie films, the producers are much more strict to only what's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And they're much more down to, we are only using exactly what we need. We'll have one pizza left over after everybody's eaten, kind of thing. But on the more network shows and stuff like that, and the commercial sets, because I've done, you know, car commercial stuff too, there's tons of waste.
Isn't it also, when you're talking about a commercial, the client who insists on all of that because they want to see what their money is going to? They want it to be in a nice set, a luxurious set.
In the TV show and in indie film world, it's mostly catering in some ways to celebrity time. And in commercial sets, the celebrity is the brand. So whatever their culture is and whatever is important to them can be important too. And usually that means the king is here, kind of big presentations of all the food and like making sure that the client is comfortable. On so many commercial sets, it's like, you know, dancing around, like the client is comfortable. Make sure that like we'll have every type of berry. So then whatever type of berry the client's favorite is, we'll have it.
You've given me a good opening to play a little bit more from our assistant director.
312 special order plate. Turkey, bread rolls, hummus, celery, Swiss cheese and peppers. Special order. Smoothie bar, matcha, banana, manuka honey, turmeric cucumber, carrot, orange, pomegranate, cinnamon, pineapple, kale.
Oh my gosh. Smoothie bar, huh?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
That doesn't sound weird to you?
Not on the bigger sets. And the thing is, I understand part of that perspective. Because to me, it isn't the problem having options. To me, the problem is the waste. It's the, well, how do we ethically make sure that we're not just consuming big amounts of trees, big amounts of material, big amounts of everything, and then flushing it out for because it's not important because of economics,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. So when you're on set, you see like paper plates and plastic cups and water bottles and plastic forks and knives, and they just get thrown away.
Yeah. Some sets try to be a little bit better about that. And ultimately, speed is important on film sets because if one person is waiting for 15 minutes, everybody needs to sync up at the same time, like a clock. If you have, you know, somebody that you're waiting a little bit longer for, then you're essentially holding everything up. So like 15 minutes of anybody being delayed.
So you're not going to wait to wash your dish.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to throw it away.
Exactly. Now, the thing is, if only there was more regulations in place to where, like, hey, we could have somebody who on bigger sets, you know, like union sets and stuff like that, has somebody who takes care of that, then all of a sudden that would just be part of the culture. That mm-hmm. would be something that's normal then, rather than what currently happens, you know, being what's normal.
Nick Kane, he works in the grip and electric department on sets. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you guys for having me.
And at 4:11 p.m. at Wrap, a powerful ginger shot for energy.
Okay, there are some organizations, just a few, trying to make a change. One of them is called EcoSet. It has a large warehouse, and it's run by a woman named Emily Heath. Her title is Reuse Coordinator. And what she and her company does is, well, they recycle props.
We call it our Materials Oasis. The Materials Oasis is where we bring all of the scenic materials, props, expendables, lumber. After a shoot is over, we bring it here, and we make it available to art community for free.
Okay, so imagine a movie set. A lot of the stuff on it needs to be built, walls, tables, chairs. You get the idea. Well, what happens after the shoot is over? Usually all of that stuff goes right into the trash and into the landfill. But for a fee, Emily and her team at EcoSet will take all of that stuff and put it in her warehouse. And then, as she said, anyone can come and get it for free. Maybe for their personal art pieces, for other movies, or supplies for homeless shelters.
Right now I'm doing a stage piece for an artist, one of my friends, for his performance.
All the toys. Yeah. I mean, there's so many kids that are going to be moving in that have nothing. They've been in shelters.
There's a wonderful little wooden piece over here on the corner. We have a Western set, and I think that with a little modification, it'll fit right in.
One man's trash, another man's treasure. Is that the solution for the environmental impact of productions in this town? To talk about this more, we have the executive director of EcoSet in the studio with me now, Chris Barberg. Hi.
Hello.
How did you come up with this idea?
Well, I wish I could take credit for it myself. I was there at the beginning, but my business partner, Shannon Bart, founded EcoSet 10 years ago, and she was freelancing in features and commercial productions and was really disheartened by the waste that she was seeing on set as well. So she founded EcoSet as a reaction to the issue of waste and misuse of resources. Primarily, we work on set behind the scenes of commercial shoots, but we also work on the back end with features and television shows to recirculate their sets and props and assets that they don't want to send to a landfill.
And what's in it for them? Because you charge a fee. Why would they pay that fee when they can just dump it in the trash for free?
I mean, the business as usual for 100 years has been, you know, just to dispose of everything after picture wrap. But a lot of brands and studio entities, networks, they have corporate social responsibility goals that they've publicly declared. And a lot of those are materials and conservation. We apply zero waste standards to our productions. And zero waste doesn't mean that no waste is created whatsoever. It just means that 90% or greater of the waste is diverted from landfill or incineration. So we apply that standard to the projects we work with on set, come up with a zero waste plan. We have like a eco crew, we're called. We're another department on set, and it's our job to do the source separating of the recycling, the compost, work with all the other departments to identify what can be reused after the shoot.
Give me an example of how it works. Let's say a production wants to hire EcoSet. They say, okay, come on, we're shooting for 5 days, then what?
Yeah, that's exactly it. The best way to work with us is in a strategic partnership where we're part of like an annual program. The example I'll give you is we just worked on a 5-day shoot, back to school commercial. And it's part of a strategic partnership we have with an advertiser, and they've been with us for 10 years.
And who's that advertiser?
We try to protect the privacy of the networks and the shows that work with us. There's a lot of intellectual property, but the advertiser we work with the most is Target. So for the last 10 years, any Target commercial you've seen probably had a sustainable behind the scenes.
Oh, so you get hired on a Target shoot. I guess this is the back to school shoot you just did?
Correct.
So what happened?
So we are involved from the very beginning through the bidding process. The different production companies that are hoping to be awarded the project are seeing a one sheet that says, here's the sustainability goals, EcoSet's our strategic partner, and then they bid the project factoring us in.
This is the company that makes the commercial.
Yep, the production companies. And then we have a separate budget, and our budget takes over all waste impacts. So dumpsters, bins and liners on set. You might go on set and just see, you know, gray trash cans, and that's pretty common across a film set. Or maybe there's one or two blue bins. But for us, it's a 3-bin sorting system. So there's green bin for all the compost and food waste. There's a blue bin for all the recyclables. And a teeny tiny little black bin for landfill. If our crew did their job sorting during the day, it's usually just one half of a black trash bag at the end of a shoot day.
Really?
Yeah, instead of all trash bags.
And that's taking into consideration the mounds of food and all of the utensils and cups and water bottles that you go through every day on a shoot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first we take a look at it. Once we're awarded a project and our budget is confirmed, we then work with the line producer, the production team, to figure out what's being created, where the shoot is taking place. If there are sets that are being built, we become the back-end plan instead of the 40-yard dumpster as a back-end plan. And so knowing some shoot days are 16 hours, you know, there's food from morning until night, you know, breakfast catering truck, lunch catering. sometimes a second meal if it's a long day, and then craft service all day long, sometimes coffee carts and smoothies.
So you have all of that, a big long day with all of that stuff, the smoothies and everything else included, and?
And so first of all, we take a look at anywhere we can do source reduction or waste prevention, and a huge part of that is the plastic water bottles that are on a lot of productions. And so instead of cases and cases of plastic bottles, for us, what that looks like is the stainless steel water bottle, and then the production rinse water refilling dispensers.
So then, and then same thing with plates and forks and knives and spoons and all that.
Yeah, we try to work with the caterer. First of all, for the sit down meal, everyone prefers, you know, a real plate and cutlery versus the plastic. So if they can cut that waste in the first place, at least for lunch, that's half of the waste. And then, you know, there's more grab and go walking meals. And so if that can be paper plates instead of styrofoam, and then if it can be compostable cutlery instead of plastic, you know, that's half the battle. But yeah, food waste is a huge, huge component. On the 5-day commercial shoot, we composted 2,400 pounds of food and soiled paper waste. So that puts it in perspective, people eating all day long.
Wow. Where does all that go? Because I don't think you can, under the law, give away food that's already been exposed, right?
Well, actually, a lot of people think that you could get sued if you donate food. That's a common misconception, but there is a workaround. It is really, really challenging to donate prepared food. Like, where does it go? Right away, within an hour of lunch.
Because it can go bad.
It can go bad, yeah.
Yeah.
So what we did is we mapped out the city of Los Angeles, and pretty much within 5 miles of a filming location, we've identified nonprofits that can take prepared food kind of at the drop of a hat. And so we call them ahead of the shoot. We get them in a holding pattern. If there's enough left over, can you come, or can we bring it to you within an hour of lunch? We don't know what time lunch is. Might be one, might be two. And if they say yes and they can be part of that process, then we're able to donate the pans of prepared catering food. Generally, it's about 80 pounds that's over-prepared and donatable. And so the protection that we use is the Federal Good Samaritan Food Donation Act. And if you give to a 501c3 nonprofit, if they sign a liability form, then the production, the caterer, EcoSet is released from liability as long as that nonprofit inspects the food before they serve it to their constituents.
So would that include homeless shelters?
Yes. Yeah.
And so why aren't more productions using your services or services like yours?
I mean, that's commonly, people think we're a nonprofit because we give everything away for free. That's sort of the loss leader part of our business. We are a service provider, so we do have fees associated with our work, especially if we have trucks and labor.
So you think that's the reason? Is it's the cost that productions don't want to spend the money?
I think, yeah, there's the cost. Another challenge is the timing, the coordination of adding one more thing to your list, of figuring out what to do with everything afterwards. I understand how challenging it is because I was a coordinator before working for EcoSet. And, you know, I'm sitting in the production office till midnight. And if someone added one more thing to my list, you know, that would have been really hard to try to do sustainability on top of coordinating the commercial.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having this conversation.
My pleasure. That's Chris Barberg. She's executive director of EcoSet. Hello there. Michelle Aloy is here.
Did you take your powerful ginger shot for energy today?
I feel like I need a powerful ginger shot. No, I haven't had it yet because it's not wrap time.
It's not wrap time?
Yeah, after wrap, I will.
Well, we've got what one might describe as a film set smorgasbord of feedback today.
We do.
We do. Frost Barnes tweets at us, "It's borderline insane not to share that food with homeless shelters. Too many people are starving. Food waste on sets or anywhere is deeply irresponsible." And Jackie Ryan has a shout out, says, "I'm listening to your segment right now," and she wants to rep an amazing organization called Rock and Wrap It Up. They will have a volunteer come on set, pick up leftover catering, and drop it at a nearby charity.
Oh, for free?
That I don't know. I can't say that I looked into this. I'm just saying Jackie Ryan's got the details.
Gotcha. Okay.
We also got some feedback on your interview with Rusty Hicks, the new head of the California Democratic Party. Ari Herstand says, Rusty Hicks just spent 10 minutes dodging every question the Mad Brand asked. He had no answers, no solutions, no passion, and no enthusiasm. Major props for calling him on his only concrete proposal that was already shot down. How does he not realize homelessness is an epidemic? And we voted to do something about it. Please do something. Stop talking about Trump. Hashtag stay local.
Okay. Okay. Got it there. You got one of his constituents right there.
Right there.
Calling him out. Okay, Michelle Aloy, thank you very much for that smorgasbord. Smorgasbord?
I don't know.
Whatever.
It's hard to say.
Yeah.
Sampler platter.
I think I need a powerful ginger shot for energy. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. See you later.